The San Jose Sharks Audio Network is on 24 hours a day. Whether you're in the office or on the go, make sure that you download the Sharks SAP Center app and hit listen anytime. You can also find us on your computer by going to sjsharks.com/listen. If it's a game broadcast, breaking news, or a player feature, the place to find it is right here on the San Jose Sharks Audio Network.
Hello out there. Welcome to The Undercurrent. I'm Tara Sloan, back again. Today, if you're a fan of the San Jose Sharks, and I know you are, or if you've lived in the Bay Area at any point over the past few decades, you know the name and you know the voice of legendary play-by-play announcer Randy Hahn. Well, on December 13th, 2022, Randy called his 2,000th regular season game, 2-0-0-0. Now, that's a feat remarkable on its own merit, of course, right? And of note, Randy only missed two games ever in his tenure with the Sharks, and those were for the births of his sons, Randall and Michael. But for Randy, this Ironman streak is imbued with so much more than just this impressive run, and that's because Randy was part of the group that lobbied to bring an NHL franchise to San Jose. Yes, the Sharks' existence in the Bay Area is in part because of Randy Hahn, so there's so much emotion wrapped up in all of this. Perhaps the most impressive to me, though, is the glint Randy has in his eye, the joy he has in his voice when he takes this trip down memory lane. After all these years, the joy has never left him. That's something. So we recorded this for the video series, The Deep, so make sure you check out that on the Sharks YouTube channel. But here in its entirety, my interview with the voice of the San Jose Sharks, Randy Hahn.
Exactly where we are. We're at SAP Center, and to many people, this is just a building. It's a place they go see sports, it's a place they go see concerts, but this place is filled with memories to you. What does this place represent?
To me, it represents that. A lot of professional memories, personal memories, but I think it represents a lot more than that to San Jose. I see this building and what goes on in this building as kind of the soul of the city. And if you go back the 30 years or so before the Sharks were here, if you were a sports fan in San Jose, you know, you cheered for the 49ers in San Francisco at Candlestick Park or the Giants when they played there, or you went to the East Bay and you went to an A's game or a Warriors game, but you didn't have your own team to cheer for. And once the Sharks came, that changed, and then once the Sharks had success in the very first year they were in this building, it kind of captured the attention of people in the whole city, not just the hardcore sports fan. I always use the analogy, you know, we have amazing technology companies in our area here, Adobe or Apple or IBM and so on and so on. If Intel comes out with the greatest new microchip, people don't high five. Yeah, we got the new chip. We got the best chip in the market. But when the Sharks won a big playoff round to kick things off that first year in San Jose, absolute strangers hugged each other in the streets and were in tears in sports bars around the Bay Area. That's the difference. And for me, that's what makes this, in a large part, the soul of the city.
Well, obviously, you're instrumental in the fact that the Sharks landed here to begin with, but I'm going to get to that. I want to talk about your personal journey. First of all, 2,000 games, let's be clear. We're talking 2,000 regular season games, right? So we're not talking playoffs.
Right.
So how many games do you think you've actually called?
Probably about another 150 playoff games.
Wow.
We've never done preseason, so that didn't factor into it as well. And then there were the odd network games involving other teams. And then most recently last year with TNT, some playoff work there. And then what a lot of Sharks fans probably don't know is that for 10 years, I was the voice of the San Diego Sockers in the old North American Soccer League and then in the Indoor League. And I did over 500 games for the San Diego Sockers, both indoor and out, over that 10-year period. And before that, not play-by-play, but studio work with the Vancouver Canucks, Edmonton Oilers, LA Kings. So there's been a lot of assignments over the years in pro sports. And then, of course, the dog sled race that everybody likes to kick off
most
interviews with.
Okay, well, I didn't kick it off with it, but I guess you led me here. So let's, you're an Edmonton-born kid. You move to Yukon territory, which is, I mean, I don't know that our audience necessarily even can, you know, picture how incredible a landscape that is. Maybe take us there for a second. Like, you know, here we are, we're in San Jose in the middle of December. What's it like in Whitehorse right now?
It's really cold. I even remember as a kid in Edmonton at Halloween, there were some Halloweens where you could just wear your costume, trick or treat, and then there were other Halloweens where you wore a parka over your costume, completely zipped up, and you'd go, zip, Halloween, trick or treat, and zip it back up because it was so cold. It's close to the Arctic Circle.
Sure.
So it's on the Alaska Highway. It's a small town of 20,000 or so people. And, you know, the winters are very severe and the summers are very short. But when I was 12 or 13 years old and our family moved there, you don't really know that to be a big change from Edmonton to go there. It's just a little bit colder and the summers are a little bit shorter. But as I look back on it now, were it not for that move by our family, maybe I wouldn't be sitting here now. I probably wouldn't be because that's where I got my chance in the Yukon Territory to broadcast at a very young age.
Okay, so it was a dog sled race, which is pretty, it's common, the Iditarod in Alaska. And so people up there do dog sled. Mm-hmm. But how did that opportunity come to you?
Well, I was already on my second radio station, and there's only two. But I was working for the CBC, Northern Service in Whitehorse. And while I was going to high school, so I would have been about 14 or 15 years old. And I was just this kid who they gave a chance to as a part-time employee. And the winter carnival in Whitehorse is called the Sourdough Rendezvous. And they have a flower packing contest, and they have the ice sculptures, and they have the Sourdough Rendezvous dog sled race. And the broadcast occurred right along the river on the train tracks in a specially dedicated train car that CBC had there for the that weekend of the carnival and for the dog sled race. But I didn't get that warm, toasty rail car. I was sent a mile out of town on this area called Dandelion Heights that overlooked the river valley with binoculars. And our main sports anchor, Terry Delaney, called the start-finish line, and then they would throw it out to me at the halfway point.
Wow.
And Chief George Van Bibber of the local First Nations tribe was my color commentator.
Amazing.
He knew the dogs by name and the mushers, as they call the drivers, and he had all the details, and I just had to determine which dogs were in the lead, which team was in the lead, and kind of relay that information back. And that was it. No tape, thankfully, exists of that broadcast because I was probably horrible. But that was the first time I did play-by-play, or my good friend Bob Miller, the Hall of Famer with the LA Kings, coined it the paw-by-paw.
Had it occurred to you before that that was something that you wanted to try?
You know, I'm not sure that it really did. When I was a kid growing up in Edmonton, I would listen to the radio late at night, and especially in the winter, the AM signal skip, and I would listen to KSL in Salt Lake, and I'd listen to KFRC from San Francisco, and these 100,000-watt radio stations from St. Louis, and it always fascinated me that I could hear people broadcasting from very far away, and maybe that's what planted the seed. And I would listen to the Edmonton Eskimos football games in my bedroom when I was a kid because those games weren't on TV, and I'd have my little earbud on or just the transistor, and I guess that's where it started. But once I got more involved in sports and did that dog sled race and then started to do a little bit more, I started to think that this maybe could turn into something where I could make a living without any heavy lifting.
Hardly. Give me some names. Who would you have emulated as you came along?
Well, you know, a man that really helped me a lot, and you may know this name having worked in Canada on the CBC, was Bill Good.
Yes.
And in those days, he was Bill Good Jr. on Hockey Night in Canada because his father was still alive, who was named Bill Good. And Bill came to Whitehorse one summer with the Montreal Canadiens. They had won the Stanley Cup. I'm talking mid-70s. And they were invited to Whitehorse to play in a softball tournament and also to go on a fly-in fishing tournament. And I was assigned to cover the tournament. Hmm. So I went to cover the tournament, and it was kind of rainy, and they had to call off some games. But the fishing trip was still on. And I'm talking a fly-in fishing trip to completely uninhabited lakes where you can literally stand on the shore, and every time you throw your line into the water, you're catching a lake trout. You know, it's amazing fishing. And my friend's father owned the fly-in fishing company that was going to take the Montreal Canadiens, and they had an extra seat. Hmm. So I got to go.
Oh, wow.
So here I am on a fly-in fishing trip with Larry Robinson and Yvon Lambert and Bunny LaRocque and all these Montreal Canadian Stanley Cup champions. And I'm this 15-year-old kid, and it's absolutely amazing. So that trip, Bill Good was on to cover it for a Hockey Night in Canada, and he kind of mentored me through that weekend, put his arm around me, and I had already been accepted to go to UBC. Bill lived in Vancouver, and he said, if you ever want to work in broadcasting in Vancouver, give me a call. Well, I'm like, yeah. Would I like to work in like the third biggest city in Canada after breaking in Whitehorse? Yes. So I called him. His friend, J. Paul McConnell, who was a very prominent broadcaster in Vancouver at the time, now retired, hired me as a part-time sports anchor. And he was a huge mentor for me. And later, Al Davidson, who was an iconic sportscaster in Vancouver. And then finally, Bernie Pascal, who is Cassie Campbell Pascal's father-in-law, really helped me launch my TV career because he arranged for me to do my first on-camera demo. And there's a story about my first on-camera demo, which is actually worth telling. I showed up, and I'm trying to get a TV job in Edmonton. It was available in my hometown. And they were looking for a sportscaster, full-time, full-on, and this would be my first TV gig. Well, I show up, and my hair is like about that long, and I have a full Freddie Prinze mustache.
Tell me you have photos.
Oh, yeah, there are photos of that. So I do the demo, and we go into an edit suite to watch the tape together, Bernie Pascal and I, and he was the primary sports anchor in Vancouver at that time, big time. And we watch it, and he said, what do you think? And I said, well, you know, I think I could have done better. And he says, here's what I think. You need to go to the barber right now, get your hair cut, go home, shave off your mustache, come back, and do exactly the same on-air work that you just did in this demo. And I'm like, are you serious? And he goes, yep, if you want that job. So I went to the barber, went home, shaved off the mustache, came back the next day, did the demo. 3 days later, I get a call from Edmonton, you're hired.
Thank you, Bernie Pascal.
No kidding.
Wow.
And it was a lesson on the difference between what your personal tastes are as somebody who's going to be a presenter and what flies in the marketplace. Now, of course, all that is relaxed to some extent. It's changed. But back then, it was a little more hardcore. And I had to learn that lesson. And thankfully, he was gracious enough to teach it to me in a very kind way. And it led to my career launching from Edmonton for only 2 years and then to California.
Okay, so let's get there. Let's get here. First of all, I mean, play-by-play, that wasn't part of your journey at that point. You were hosting, right?
Right. But my last year in Edmonton, I did the play-by-play of the Edmonton Drillers soccer team. Huh. And they played both outdoor and indoor. And the indoor soccer game is almost the same as hockey. Number one, it's played on an NHL rink with AstroTurf over it, three forwards, two defenders, and a goalkeeper. Well, that's the same configuration as hockey. The only difference being the play off the boards in indoor soccer is a lot more than, you know, you don't use the boards so much to score goals in the NHL. In soccer, you did. But anyway, I had that rhythm and that cadence and the things you need to be able to see a name, say a name, and describe the play built into what I was starting to grow into doing. And then I got an opportunity to go to San Diego to do the San Diego Soccers, and I did them for 10 years. So I further honed that craft, and near the end of that time with the Soccers is when I got my opportunity in the NHL with the LA Kings. So I didn't have the traditional path of coming up through the minor leagues in hockey, like the East Coast League or the American Hockey League, but I did my time and learned my way and made my mistakes and learned the technical side of the TV business in the soccer realm, but it translated.
So it's the late 80s, you end up in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And this is when everything starts to percolate. Hockey's in your blood. Is it necessarily in the blood of the people here? I don't know, but you thought, along with a group of other people, that this was going to be a viable market for NHL hockey.
Yeah, the city of San Jose had just voted to build this building, San Jose Arena, as it was known until it started getting corporate naming on it. And the speculation back then, and I'm talking about 88, 89, was that the Warriors were going to move to San Jose because they needed a major renovation in Oakland and it didn't seem like it was coming. So that was the speculation. Let's build this arena and then the Warriors will come here. Well, that didn't happen. And we didn't know that it wasn't going to happen, but a group of us formed an entity called NHL Hockey San Jose. And it was more than a fan club. We wanted to try and go about in a little bit more of a business-like manner to try and attract the NHL's attention to this building, just in case the Warriors didn't want to move here. And so we formed, two of the individuals were attorneys, Jim Hager and Greg Seal, and they still are here in San Jose, and Roberto Maragonia, an accountant. And they said, let's form a California nonprofit corporation to make this thing look legitimate, so that we're not just a fan club waving banners in front of City Hall saying, we want hockey. And I was already working for the LA Kings at the time, so I was traveling all around the league. I had the ability to market our group a little bit and pass pamphlets along when I saw GMs or governors or coaches and just kind of spread the gospel about not our group so much as what San Jose was, because this city was still somewhat unknown because Silicon Valley was in its infancy. It was the beginning of all that. The internet wasn't even a thing in the late 80s. So people weren't quite sure about the commerce here and what was coming to what we see today. It's one of the greatest economic engines in the world. And with the help of these gentlemen who had some foresight and my feeling that something was brewing here, we gained some traction. We got the attention of the league, number one, by calling ourselves NHL. They told us to stop doing that, which we did. And that's kind of why we did it. We wanted to get their attention. And then more people in the league started becoming interested in us. And one of our greatest boosters was Brian Burke, who's now with the Pittsburgh Penguins in there. I believe he's their president. And of course, a Stanley Cup champion general manager with the Anaheim Ducks. And at that time, he worked for the Vancouver Canucks and was extremely helpful and instrumental in what we did.
Huh. I didn't know that about Berkey. That's great.
Yeah.
The mayor wasn't even on board for quite a while. What was the tipping point for him?
My good buddy now, Mayor Tom McHenry, he was the mayor at the time. And, you know, it was like, who are these lunatics that want to bring a hockey team to San Jose? I mean, the only ice we know around here is what's in our margarita glasses. and he kept us like at arm's length for as long as he could. But Dean Monroe, who was his number two in the mayor's office, you know, eventually we got through to him. And Dean realized that what we were talking about was something that was legitimate. And then Brian Burke became involved, and we were able to come to the mayor and say, look, here is an assistant general manager of the Vancouver Canucks who is willing to share the business plan of the Canucks and how they interact with their arena and take you through the process of what it would be like to have a hockey team here. And Brian flew to San Jose, and we finally met with Mayor McHenry and had this hockey summit That was the game changer. That's when McHenry got on board and he realized this really could be something. And especially with the influx of technology workers who were coming from places like Boston, Pittsburgh, Ottawa, New York. These were hockey markets, and we were getting engineers and innovators coming to the Valley who had it in their blood. And you could start seeing, hey, this might not just be something that is going to struggle for a long time. We may have some built-in audience here already. And sure enough, that's what happened.
So you would think it would be a given. You're part of this group. You get the team established here. You go through the application process to be the play-by-play announcer, and you don't get the job at first.
Well, there was a pivot right at the end of the process of the Sharks coming into being. And that we had worked with Howard Baldwin, who is the former owner of the Hartford Whalers in the WHA, a great hockey person. And he wasn't the owner of Hartford anymore. He was a private individual with financing that was going to be the owner of the San Jose franchise. And he already had a letter of agreement with the city of San Jose. Well, at the last minute, the Gund family, who owned the Minnesota North Stars at that time, but also had strong Bay Area ties, expressed their desire to be the ownership group in San Jose. So they were already existing owners. They had more leverage. And they did a negotiation with Baldwin and his group where they sold the North Stars to Baldwin for the rights to San Jose. And all of a sudden, overnight, my guaranteed job with Howard Baldwin as the announcer for the Sharks wasn't a guarantee anymore. And the Gund family came in with their own marketing people, and their decision, and I don't argue with it necessarily, was they wanted to have a big Bay Area name be their first play-by-play announcer to make a splash. And Joe Starkey was that name. You know, in the late 80s and 90s, Joe was the radio voice of the 49ers. He was the radio voice for Cal football and basketball. So he was on the air everywhere, and I'm sure he did other things that I don't even know about, but those were his three big things. So they gave it to Joe, and he had previous to that been in the NHL with the Colorado Rockies doing their play-by-play, so he had some background in pro hockey. So he was the first TV announcer hired. It was a real disappointment and devastating at the time, but it actually worked out because the producer of those games, Mark Stolberger, was also my producer with the LA Kings previously, and he hired me to fill in for the games that Joe Starkey couldn't do because of conflicts. And Mark Stolberger also knew the sweat equity I had put into the whole San Jose venture. So I got to do those games the first 2 years, and then by year three, they asked Joe to make a decision. Sharks or your other stuff? We want one announcer. And it was really hard for him to walk away from the 49ers and Cal. I mean, that was in his blood for a long time. So I'm sure it was tough for him, but he just said, I can't make that decision. I'll have to let hockey go. And that was the day I got offered the job, and I've had it ever since.
So your first, I want to make sure I get the date right, because your first day announcing was a fill-in day, but it was still your first NHL game. October of 1991, October 26th. What do you remember? I mean, I can't even imagine. I'm having an out-of-body experience. I'd be so scared. Were you?
Well, first of all, I had never done the play-by-play of an NHL game in my life.
Right?
I mean, you have to, you know, somewhere it has to be your first one. I had done color on the first ever home game with Dan Rusinowski, but not play-by-play. So here I am flying to New Jersey. I'm not on the team plane. I'm going there commercial because I'm meeting them in the middle of a road trip. I'm going into a building I've never been in before, sitting at a booth with a color guy that I hadn't worked with before. And there I was. And of course you're nervous and you know, a little bit frightened as to how it will go and how you'll be received. But you know, once the puck's dropped, then you're locked in and you start getting into game mode and you don't think about all those things. You just do what you have been doing with the indoor soccer thing for 10 years and you grew up around hockey, you know the game, and you just start doing your thing. So I think the score at the end of the first period was 2-0 Devils. And then the end of the second period was 5-0 Devils. The final score was 9-0 Devils. I mean, it was just an absolute thrashing. And Claude Lemieux was on. He was the first star of that game. He was on that New Jersey team. He became a Shark. Chris Terreri was the goalie. He became a Shark. Dave Barr, played for the Devils in that game. He had just been called up from the minors for that game and has a great story about that day himself. He became an assistant coach of the Sharks. I'm so linked to that game with people who ended up having San Jose links. But, you know, it's sort of one of those things where it's over. You're like, I got through it. But you're also like, oh, man, did we ever get our butts kicked? And as it would turn out, it would be 8 or 9 games in before I broadcast a win. I was like 0-8. And I was like, don't tell anybody, because I knew the superstitions in hockey. It would be like, oh, yeah, here comes Mr. Bad Luck. We're going to get rid of him at the end of the year. So I never told anybody about that until years later.
They didn't notice?
When it wouldn't matter anymore.
Okay, so I know you've been reliving this as you're celebrated over the last few weeks, but I'm going to ask you to do it for our purposes, if you don't mind. There are two games that I think I know stand out to you. And, of course, it's the April 30th, 1994, the famous Jimmy Baker goal to seal the deal in Game 7. Just how does it make you feel when you think about that?
It's still the best memory I have in this job because of the buildup of being involved in a minor way of the team ending up here. And then because it was the first year in San Jose after the team had to play at the Cal Palace for 2 years, it was our first year at the brand new arena and there was so much excitement. The team snuck into the playoffs at the very end of the year as the 8th seed. And for that, we got the reward of playing the Red Wings, who not only were the 1 seed, but they were the favorites to win the Stanley Cup. And Sergei Fedorov and Steve Yzerman and on and on and on with a loaded hockey team. And we sneak in at the very end. And Jamie Baker scored in the game that we clinched in L.A. And who would know that would be foreboding for me with what is still the greatest moment in Sharks history. And we go into that series as just a huge underdog, like they'll sweep them or it'll end in 5. You know how all those predictions are. Well, all of a sudden we go to Detroit. In those years, it was 2-3-2 format for the best of 7. So we go to Detroit and we get a split. It's like, great. Then we come home and now San Jose is in full-blown hockey mania. Are you kidding me? Not only did we make the playoffs, we've already won a game in this series. And it's on, all of a sudden it's on ESPN, and the name San Jose is appearing in sports reports where that never happened before for this city, or minimally at best. So now we win 2 out of 3 at home. We're going back to Detroit for 2 games, and we just need to win 1. And we're going to upset them. Still a lot of skeptics that we could do that. So we go to Game 6, and we get absolutely thrashed, blown out. I forget the score. It was like probably 6-1. It wasn't even close. So now everybody's, well, there you go. You know, the fairy tale story is over. That's the end of Cinderella. She's going to get crushed in Game 7. And it's 2-2 in the third period, and our team is just battling and fighting, and there was no carryover from Game 6 at all, which is quite common in playoffs. There's not that much momentum usually from one game to another. And then with about 13 minutes left to go, you know, Chris Osgood chases a puck into the corner and tries to clear it himself and doesn't get the puck out. He's scrambling back to the net, and we've got a screen in front. I think it was Bob Airy gets to the front of the net, and Bakes hits the face-off circle and just fires the puck on net, and it goes in.
Now Whitney. He's all alone. He'll push it to the corner. Chase after it. Trailing is Baker. They score! Sharks score! They lead 3-2!
Now there's still 12 and a half minutes or 13 to go, and those are like, you know, but and you're trying to carry that emotion on the air, but at the same time hopeful that it'll work out, and it did. And you know, Urbe was amazing, and the team defended that lead to the very end, and they pulled the goalie, but they couldn't beat us, and we pulled off what is still to this day one of the greatest playoff upsets in NHL history. And as it ended, I'm not gonna lie, I was crying.
Yeah.
Off camera, because of having something to do with the team from its infancy, and then like 3 years later, this thing that was just kind of an idea just knocked off the Red Wings. Mm. It was absolutely stunning to me, and it's still, when I think back on that, it just brings up memories of excitement, of pride, and so much happiness for the players and for the city, because it meant a lot to San Jose.
And then the other goal, the Barkley Goodrow. I mean, that's, I know that's the other one that makes your heart swell. What's your recollection?
That's the greatest game in Sharks history. Mm-hmm. If Bakes scoring and them winning that game is the greatest moment for me, that game is the greatest game, because game six was phenomenal with Tomas Hertl scoring shorthanded in double overtime to send it back to San Jose. I mean, that's how close we were to that game seven never happening and that opportunity never existing.
Tomas Hertl shorthanded, shoots, and scores! Tomas Hertl hits the jackpot!
But Hertl does it, and Martin Jones played the game of his life, 56 or 58 saves in that double overtime game six. So now we go to game seven, and it's not going well. Vegas scores first, and they score second, and now we're in the third period, and it's 3-0, and I'm going to be honest with you. I'm now starting to think, what am I going to say during the handshake line? Because I don't want to be disingenuous. Vegas, they beat us, right? But the Sharks deserve credit for forcing this game seven and putting up a fight. And, you know, you want to leave the fans in that final game with something they can carry over the summer that gives them hope. And deservedly so. And then all of a sudden, it happens. Cody Eakin cross-checks Joe Pavelski. Down he goes. There's blood on the ice. There's immediate concern for Joe's well-being. And now it's a you know, the referees huddle. Major penalty, five-minute power play. And now is the opportunity. And I always remember Bob Airey, who was our captain in 93-94 when we beat the Red Wings in that game seven. And he had a list of 16 things to remember to do in the playoffs, because you need 16 wins to win the Stanley Cup. And one of them was, you're never out of a game, there could be a 5-minute major. Huh. And I immediately thought of that. And I went like, here it is. Here's one of Bibbsy we call him. Here's one of Bibbsy's 16. It's a 5-minute major. The Sharks are on the power play. They can score as many times as they want. One. And then Logan says, that's one. And then we get the second. And then we get the third. And Kevin LeBanc is having the game of his life. And we've now tied it. And the building is like it's never, ever, ever been. And then it went one more level higher as we take the lead. And it's like, oh my God, this is incredible. Then Jonathan Marchessault ties it with like a minute and a half left. And you go like, oh my God, this greatest comeback is going to be for naught. We're going to blow this thing in overtime, or maybe even in regulation. And then, of course, it goes to the overtime. And, you know, sometimes our fans forget who made the pass to Barkley Goodrow. It was Erik Karlsson. And it was perfect. And Goodrow was, he was on the bench for most of that game. Pete DeBoer wasn't happy with Barkley's game. He wasn't having a good game. I think he played 5 or 6 minutes. Well, now we need fresher legs in overtime. He throws them out there. And Carly finds Goody, and then the rest is history. And it was absolutely pandemonium, and a moment like a game I had never been like. I've done World Cup, I've done a lot of hockey games, I've done a lot of events, but I'd never been at a sporting event, let alone be able to broadcast one like that game seven. And to do it against your bitter rival, yes! It felt so good.
Karlsson comes in. Here's Barkley Goodrow. He scores! Barkley Goodrow and the Sharks just won one of the most remarkable comeback games, and they've won the series.
Watching Gerard Gallant have to shake hands at center ice after that one, because earlier in the series, he had called Pete DeBoer publicly a clown.
Oof. Gerard. You know, watching you recount this, and this is not the first time you've done this. I mean, you're asked to kind of relive this over and over. Your face is like a kid on Christmas morning. Why? What keeps you so fresh and engaged?
It's the games. I get to come to work here at SAP or when we're on the road, and the place hopefully has 17 or 18,000 people in it. It's couples, it's first dates, it's families, it's first games for kids. There's food, there's the smell of the hot dogs, there's beers, there's sodas, there's souvenirs. It's a party. Every time I get to work and I get plopped into the middle of that, and the beauty of it is you don't know what kind of party it's going to be, because you don't know what's going to happen in that game. Is it going to be another run-of-the-mill game? Yeah, okay, we were at another game and, you know, the Sharks won 4-2 or they lost 3-1. Or are you going to see something you've never seen before? You don't know. You never know what is going to happen. When you walk into the rink, do you think Timo Meier is going to score 5 goals against the LA Kings?
It's Hurdle. Across for Meier. Toe drag. He did it! History at the Shark Tank as Timo Meier becomes the first San Jose Shark in 31 years to score 5 goals in a game.
Another one of your bitter rivals? You don't know that, but you have to be ready for that. And then once it starts happening as a broadcaster, you have to hook onto that and you have to bring that to your audience who's not at that game. They're watching it on TV. And that's the fun. When you get those moments and those runs and those incredible moments, that's why you do this. That's what you live for. And that's why it's never boring.
And that's why you are so beloved and so damn good, Randy. Congratulations on your milestone.
Thank you, Tara. My pleasure.
Now, as you can imagine, Randy had a lot of media requests during that time, kind of leading up and during his milestone game. So, Randy, thank you for taking the time to sit down with us. And congratulations to you. What an incredible accomplishment. I honestly think Randy is vastly underrated because not everybody in the East Coast gets to see these Western Conference games. And Randy is truly among the best in the business. So here's to 2,000 more. And for everybody out there, don't forget, we're looking for your guest ideas. So make sure you contact me if you can on Twitter at Tara Sloan, TaraSlone. Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Undercurrent. I'll see you next week. In the meantime, keep your fins above water. Oh yeah, I'm just going to keep saying it. I'm going with it. I like it.